won militarily from one side, and therefore it is essential that we do all we can to ensure there is a ceasefire.
According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue, that's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian Defence Minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist. He explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticised for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonised. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corrie from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corrie became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corrie, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corrie's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things the Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corrie acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military operation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the news on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
The drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now. Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Cut away the gigantic mountain to get to your love. It was an impossible condition set by the 6th century Iranian king Khosrow to dissuade Farhad from marrying Shirin, his love. But the enchanted lover accepted the daring offer and used his sculpting axe to dig through Mount Bisotun. But halfway through, Farhad heard the sad news that King Khosrow had already married Shirin. This tragic love story still echoes in the Iranian city of Kermanshah and Mount Bisotun, which is now hosting visitors from across Iran to celebrate the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz. Bisotun is just one of many historical sites in Iran's western province of Kermanshah. Anahita Temple is equally significant. The historical monument was constructed back in the 4th century BC to honor the goddess of water, Anahita. And in the heart of Kermanshah lies this amazing stone arch called Tagh-e-Bostan, which dates back to some 2,400 years ago. What made it even more attractive is music performances by local ensembles who sing and play the tambour instrument, to ring in Nowruz.
Happy Nowruz to all Iranians. Today our group played the tambour, an old Iranian instrument that is 8,000 years old. We hosted music bands from other parts of Iran and enjoyed their performances.
Kermanshah was the second stop for the caravan of Nowruz, comprising cultural activists from across Iran, who took part to welcome the Persian New Year, due on March 21st. The caravan set out from Hamadan, got here in Kermanshah, and will move on to Sanandaj, all to display Iran's cultural diversity. That's the result of peaceful coexistence of many ethnicities in the country.
Nowruz is celebrated by over 300 million people worldwide, with each nation having its own unique style in marking the occasion. Now, these people say Nowruz is a time to celebrate these differences, as they make the ancient festivity one of the most ethnically diverse cultural events in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kermanshah.
An emergency meeting of NATO defense ministers concluded at the military alliance's headquarters in Brussels on Wednesday. They are ready to defend NATO countries in the event Russia expands its mission beyond Ukraine, it's claimed.
There are now hundreds of thousands of forces at heightened alert across the alliance. 100,000 US troops in Europe.
A number of analysts have asked the question, how would Washington feel if Russia positioned 100,000 of its troops, for example, in Mexico? NATO military commanders have been ordered to examine how there can be even further expansion with respect to land, sea, air, cyber, and space capabilities. Jens Stoltenberg has called on NATO members to spend at least 2% of their GDP to grow military forces in response to Russia. Western powers say they won't get directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, but will continue to spend billions on arming Ukraine.
Certainly, we support their ability to defend themselves, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
Unprecedented sanctions against Moscow are starting to hit the EU's economy hard as fuel prices continue to rise and the cost of living generally goes up.
Those are substantial costs that will have to be paid by the EU collectively, but of course they will hit certain countries harder.
Sanctions are not the answer when it comes to dealing with Russia, according to some experts.
It's not a good situation because it seems to me there are a few mistakes. First of all, such kind of sanctions will be counterproductive generally. It's a way to confrontation.
As the war rages on, Joe Biden and other NATO leaders are due to hold a summit in the Belgian capital on Thursday of next week to consider further options. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Mid Shaban is one of Muslims' great Eids, marking the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam. Afghans gathered here at Sahi Shrine in Kabul to pay tribute to their last Imam and celebrate the occasion.
I congratulate Afghans and other Muslims on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi. This is a joyous Eid for us and we have come here to celebrate it. Prophet Muhammad has promised the advent of Mahdi and we are eagerly waiting for that day. May he come and fill the world with justice and peace.
Fortunately, here everything looks great. People are happy celebrating Mid Shaban. As an Afghan, I mark the birth anniversary of Mid Shaban every year, but today it's different. More families have come here since the security threats are gone.
Kabul residents decorate the Sahi Shrine and hold traditional ceremonies, announcing their allegiance to Imam Mahdi. They also take the occasion as a chance for highlighting Islamic solidarity among Muslims. At the same time, the Taliban say they will tighten the security during the Eid.
God willing, we have tightened security everywhere. We are serving all people of Afghanistan and don't let anything or anyone threaten them. Today, people can mark their occasions without trouble.
People in Afghanistan have been struggling with poverty and hunger crisis. In the meantime, they don't miss any chance to mark cultural occasions and to spread Islamic bliss. People have come here for the love of their last Imam, Hazrat Mahdi. They observe Mid Shaban as a great Eid and hold such ceremonies every year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The British judicial system has erected still another barrier to Julian Assange freedom. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Marjorie Khan Ryder. This article is published under the heading Extradition Looms for Assange after UK Supreme Court refuses to hear his appeal. Here's the story. The British judicial system has erected still another barrier to Julian Assange freedom. On March 14th, the UK Supreme Court refused to hear Assange's appeal of the UK High Court's ruling ordering his extradition to the United States. If extradited to the US for trial, Assange will face 17 charges under the Espionage Act and up to 175 years in prison for revealing evidence of US war crimes. With no explanation of its reasoning, the Supreme Court denied Assange permission to appeal the High Court's decision, saying that Assange's appeal did not raise an arguable point of view. The court remanded the case back to the Westminster's Magistrates Court, which is the same court that denied the U.S. extradition request on January 4, 2021. In all likelihood, the Magistrates Court will refer the case to the British Home Office, where Home Secretary Priti Patel will review it. Assange lawyers then have 4 weeks to submit materials for Patel's consideration. If she orders Assange extradition, which is highly likely, his lawyers will file a cross-appeal in the High Court asking it to review the issues Assange lost in the Magistrates Court. If the High Court refuses to review those additional issues, Assange can appeal to the European Court of Human Rights. That could take years. Meanwhile, he languishes in London's high-security Belmarsh prison in fragile mental and physical health. He suffered a mini-stroke as his extradition hearing began. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture Nils Meltzer wrote in a Twitter post that the UK is literally torturing him to death. On January 24, 2022, the High Court rejected Assange's appeal, but it certified to the Supreme Court that Assange had raised a point of law of general public importance. This means that it is a proper issue for the Supreme Court to review. The three-judge panel of the Supreme Court has now refused Assange's permission to appeal. The United States waited until after the extradition hearing was over to offer UK District Judge Vanessa Baritzer assurances about the way Assange would be treated in the U.S. prisons if extradited. Following a three-week evidentiary hearing, Baritzer ruled on January 4, 2021, that if Assange is extradited to the United States for trial, he is very likely to attempt suicide due to his mental state and the harsh conditions of confinement under which he would be held in the U.S. prisons. During the hearing, the U.S. government did not assure Baritzer that Assange would not be held in solitary confinement in the United States. After Baritzer denied extradition, the Biden administration provided assurances that Assange wouldn't be subject to Special Administrative Measures, SAMs, or be housed at ADX Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. But the United States' so-called assurances contained a loophole big enough to drive a truck through. All assurances would be void if Assange committed a future act that met the test for the imposition of SAMs. That subjective determination would be made by prison officials with no judicial review. Although the late timing of the U.S. assurances prevented Assange lawyers from arguing they were unreliable and citing prior such assurances, the United States failed to honor the High Court, accepted Biden's assurances, and dismissed Assange's appeal in its January 2022 ruling. Julia Hall, Amnesty International's Deputy Research Director for Europe, called the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal a blow to Julian Assange and to justice. Hall said, demanding that states like the UK extradite people for publishing classified information that is in the public interest sets a dangerous precedent and must be rejected. She added, prolonged solitary confinement is a key feature of life for many people in U.S. maximum security prisons and amounts to torture or other ill treatment under international law. The ban on torture and other ill treatment is absolute and empty promises of fair treatment, such as those offered by the USA in the Assange case, threaten to profoundly undermine that international prohibition. Likewise, Reporters Without Borders, RSF, expressed a strong opposition to the Supreme Court's decision. Assange case is overwhelmingly in the public interest and it deserved review by the highest court in the UK. After 2 full years of extradition proceedings, once again Assange's fate has become a political decision, said Rebecca Vincent, RSF's Director of Operations and Campaigns, adding, "We call on the Home Office to act in the interest of journalism and press freedom by refusing extradition and releasing Assange from prison without further delay." Assange's fiancé says U.S. wants to imprison him for exposing its war crimes. Stella Morris, Assange's fiancé, says Assange is being persecuted for carrying out a core journalistic mission, telling the truth. Whether Giuliani is extradited or not, which is the same as saying whether he lives or dies, is being decided through a process of legal avoidance, Morris said, adding, avoiding to hear arguments that challenge the UK court's deference to the unenforceable and coveted claims regarding his treatment made by the United States, the country that plotted to murder him. The country whose atrocities he brought into the public domain, Giuliani is the key witness, the principal indictor, and the cause of enormous embarrassment to successive U.S. governments. Morris added, Giuliani was just doing his job, which was to publish the truth about wrongdoing. His loyalty is the same as that which all journalists should have to the public, not to the spy agencies of a foreign power. According to Morris, the United States wants to imprison Assange for 175 years because he published evidence that the country that is trying to extradite him committed war crimes and covered them up, that it committed gross violations that killed tens of thousands of innocent men, women and children, that it tortured and rendered, that it bombed children, had death squads and murdered Reuters journalists in the cold blood, that it bribed foreign officials and bullied less powerful countries into harming their own citizens, and that it also corrupted allied nations' judicial inquiries into U.S. wrongdoing.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. One thing about Ba'atha is that it achieved something that seemed impossible. This prophetic experience can be repeated throughout history. This experience happened to the Iranian nation. We were really in the middle of the arena and we were aware of the development. If any of us had been told that such a thing was possible, we would not have believed it. But it happened. The revolution liberated the Iranian nation from lethargy and it set the people to motion. Not only did the revolution show its greatness to the world, but it also rendered the Iranian nation great and made the world see the greatness of Islamic Iran. This is the first point. If we move in the line of Ba'atha, we will make impossibilities possible and we will be able to attain goals that seem unattainable. The next point about the Holy Prophet's Ba'atha, greetings be upon him and his household, is that there are some people who believe that religion is separate from politics.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They consider religion as completely separate from life, politics and government. There are many individuals who work to that end. There were such individuals in the past as well. But their efforts were counteracted with the revolutionary movement. In the present time, however, one sees that some people have resumed whispering such ideas with their words and writings. Contrary to the opinion of such people, the peak of the prophetic movement was establishment of government. It was the Holy Prophet himself who laid the groundwork for that. He spoke with the chiefs of Medina who had heard about Islam and who had come to see what it was about. He reached an agreement with them and the great personalities of Yathrib. At that time, Medina was called Yathrib. Prepared the ground for that. Then the Holy Prophet began his astonishing migration to that city, followed by other Muslims. Little by little, the immigrants arrived in that city. Before the migration, the Holy Prophet sent an emissary to Yathrib.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates, one in which the Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. What has caused the UAE to positively welcome Syria back to the fold so warmly? Meanwhile, the U.S. has slammed this rapprochement. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind this about-face and look at whether the ones who were behind the war on Syria have learned their lessons. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Kent Stone. joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Also joining us, author and researcher Daniel Kovalik joins us from Pittsburgh, VA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Ken Stone. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visiting the UAE, his first such visit to an Arab country since the beginning of the foreign-backed, war, if you want to call it, in Syria. Why do you think that's happening at this time with the UAE in particular and not with other Arab countries?
Well, it is happening with other Arab countries as well, on a limited scale. Jordan has reopened a border and made approaches to the Syrian government, and so has Lebanon. The Algerian government, of course, has always maintained good relations throughout the whole U.S. regime change war with Syria, maintained an embassy in Damascus, had regular flights to Damascus. It's not, the UAE is not the only country that is making a rapprochement with Syria and the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. Why is it happening at this time? I think there's a lot of things happening in the world at this time. I think the U.S. defeat in Afghanistan, its chaotic withdrawal with its tail between its legs, signaled to many of the countries of the Middle East that maybe they weren't so secure under the so-called protection of under the umbrella of the U.S. empire as they thought they were. And maybe it's time to rethink some of their long-held relations and positions.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm sorry to jump in. I'd like to find out, that statement you made there is pretty profound, so I'd like to get from you, Daniel Kovalik. Is that what's happening, that maybe the countries in West Asia, or Middle East as they're called, are realizing that really the U.S. protection is not all that it's sounded to be? I mean, when you have the Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, for example, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, saying that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. He uses the word fundamental pillar of Arab security. And if you go back 5 years ago, you would not even imagine that the UAE would say that. So is that what we're looking at, the fact that the U.S. is not A, that security guarantee that the nations thought, and B, that is, from what they say, withdrawing itself somewhat from the region?
Well, I think certainly that's part of it. But I think the other part of it is, it comes to mind an expression here in the United States: if you can't beat them, join them. They tried to beat Assad. They lost, right? They tried to unseat him. He wasn't unseated. He's not going to be unseated. So now they have to deal with him, because they're right. Look, Syria is a very important country in the Middle East, and it always has been. The UAE, Saudi Arabia, other countries thought they could overthrow the government there, and they simply were unable to, in part because of Russia's intervention. And so now they have to deal with that government. It's very simple. We see a similar thing happening between the U.S. and Venezuela, right? The U.S. tried to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro. It recognized Juan Guaido as a president there. It thought it could impose Guaido upon Venezuela. It was unable to. So what's happening now? The U.S. has gone hat in hand to Nicolas Maduro asking for oil. So it's a simple, you know, thing that, you know, you try to kill the king, and if you can't, you better deal with him. So that's really, I think, what's happening here.
Well, Kent Stone, you talked about some of the other Arab countries that are actually also reestablishing their ties with Syria. I'm curious as to the weight that Saudi Arabia would have in this, and also the Arab League, maybe by default, because we know that the Arab League has not had kind words for Syria, but Saudi Arabia, as they say, is the heavyweight. If it was to reestablish itself fully, then the Arab League would follow, and then maybe the other countries of the PGCC would then also follow. Is that the way this would turn out, do you think?
It might be. The Arab League threw Syria. It expelled Syria out of the league back in November 12, 2011. And that was part of the plan to delegitimize the Assad government of Syria and to isolate the government of Syria. And by the way, the UAE was one of the first countries to be involved in the so-called Friends of Syria group. It was there along with Hillary Clinton in Tunis in February 2012 at a meeting that was partially organized through the Canadian embassy in Tunisia, because Canada too was part of the regime change operation in Syria. So the UAE has come a long way. It reestablished its embassy in Syria in 2018. And its foreign minister visited Syria last November, I believe. So Saudi Arabia taking a similar step be a key turning point? I would think so. But it might be forced to, because the Algerian government, which is the host of the Arab summit, which was supposed to take place in three days from now, March 22nd, but has been postponed because of COVID problems. At that meeting, Algeria said it wanted Syria to participate. And if Algeria got its way, then the Saudi Arabians would have really no choice but either to join the meeting or to snub the whole Arab League.
Okay. Let's look at other statements that have transpired by UAE officials here, Daniel Kovalik, and one in particular that I'd like to find out how this can actually be the case, where Sheikh Mohammed said that this visit would be the beginning of peace and stability for Syria and the entire region. How do you go from peace and stability in Syria to then apply that to the entire region based on the way that Sheikh Mohammed sees it? How do you think he sees that?
Well, I definitely think that having peace in Syria is an important element to having peace in the Middle East, because, of course, you know, the war in Syria has adversely affected Lebanon, for example, in a big way. And, of course, the Syrian war has produced a huge number of refugees, again, many of which have gone into Lebanon but have gone into other countries. So, of course, ending that conflict for good is a big start to peace in the Middle East. But I think they must have other ideas that other conflicts maybe will be coming to an end. Obviously, a big conflict that has to come to an end is the mostly Saudi and UAE war on Yemen, which, of course, the U.S. and U.K. are backing as well. Maybe they're thinking that that's going to come to an end soon, too, which I hope, of course, it will. So, I mean, I am hoping that countries in the Middle East are starting to realize that they can no longer go along with the destabilization project of the United States, which the U.S. began well, a long time ago, really, by supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in 1979, but more recently by invading Afghanistan in 2001 and then Iraq for the second time in 2003. And hopefully the as Ken mentioned, with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, maybe they now see that that many years of intervention of war has now come to an end and that they're ready to end that for good. I hope that's true. You certainly see the end of U.S. hegemony in the world. You know, one big other thing that's happening is that Saudi Arabia said that it's thinking about stopping the use of the U.S. dollar for oil trade, which would be huge. And again, that is also signaling that the day of U.S. hegemony may be over. So there are big things happening, as Ken said, in the world, and it is shifting away very quickly from the United States.
Well, another profound thing here that was said, Ken Stone, and this I'm assuming means the U.S. as one of the parties, where when the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was speaking to the UAE official Sheikh Mohammed, he said preserving the territorial integrity of Syria is important, and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. Now, isn't that a direct reference to the U.S., which is one of the foreign countries that are there without the invitation of the Syrian government?
Of course it is. But before I answer, go further on that question, I want to pick up something that that Dan, your other guest, and my colleague from the United States has said. He's mentioned the war on Yemen, and I know that the that Press TV covers the war on Yemen extensively, giving voice to the voiceless. Next weekend in Canada, there will be a weekend of action to stop the war on Yemen and to stop Canadian arms sales to Saudi Arabia. That's March 26th and 27th. I just wanted to mention that for the benefit of your viewers in Canada and elsewhere in the world.
Thank you for that.
As to the point that you were raising about Syria, President Assad referring to the territorial integrity of Syria, he has every right to make that point. And it's not just the U.S. he's referring to, I am sure, but also to Turkey, which maintains a buffer along the northern frontier of Syria and is also propping up a number of terrorist groups in the only part of the rest of the country which is still held by terrorist mercenaries, namely the province of Idlib. So, Syria is definitely always says that they will liberate every square inch of their territory, and so far with the help of the governments of Iran and Russia and the help of Hezbollah in the Lebanon and other popular militias among the Palestinians and Iraqis and so on, they have been slowly taking back the country into the hands of the Syrian people.
Daniel Kovalik, you raised a very important point there when you talked about how Saudi Arabia is considering pricing some of its oil sales in the petro yuan. And that is big, as you said, on the one hand, in terms of the effect and impact it's going to have on the U.S. dollar. But more importantly, how we're seeing the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to a frayed. At the same time, we're looking at the way that the UAE is receiving Syria, and at least we're under the impression, unless I'm wrong, I could be, you tell us, whether that relationship is also somewhat going on the rocks, maybe, which is quite confusing at this point to see whether both, then, UAE and Saudi Arabia, do not have that much of a strong relationship with the U.S. when you have the U.S. State Department net price come out and say profoundly disappointed and troubled by this apparent attempt to legitimize Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, well, again, the other thing we see is that apparently the UAE and Saudi Arabia are not taking President Biden's phone calls, right? I mean, something's going on. And maybe, again, with the withdrawal from Afghanistan and with the Russian invasion in Ukraine, I think now Saudi Arabia and UAE are starting to wonder what side, you know, their toast is truly buttered on and whether they've cozied up to the wrong power all this time. I mean, clearly there's signs that they're rethinking their alignment in the world. Of course, it was always going to be an alignment that was precarious, right? Because cozying up to the U.S. also meant cozying up to Israel, which is oppressing the Palestinian people, which, you know, the Gulf states at one point seemed to care about the Palestinian people, you know, who are fellow Arabs. Then they seem to not care anymore. But I think, you know, obviously they have historic ties with the Palestinians. I think, you know, aligning with Israel could not have felt tremendously comfortable for them. And now maybe they've decided they don't have to do that anymore. So you could see big changes. And again, I hope they're changes that do inure to the benefit of the people in Palestine and Yemen. Maybe finally, you know, the Gulf states realize, you know, that their loyalties need to lie elsewhere. And, mm-hmm. and we're certainly seeing signs of that right now.
Well, I'm looking at it as tectonic shifts, really. Geopolitical alignment, in a sense, Kent Stone, at the way that countries within West Asia or Middle East are perhaps aligning themselves. The problem that I'm seeing here, and I'm asking you, since our guests there talked about Palestine, is the fact that you have the UAE that has normalized ties with Israel. So how does that work into the equation when the UAE and Syria are getting close, they're signing MOUs? I think at one point UAE, when its foreign minister visited Syria, said, we're going to actually invest in Syria. We're going to put up investments in electricity. But then you have Israel that's bombing Syria on the one hand, and then you have the normalization take place with Israel on the other, which doesn't line up with what Syria is all about.
Okay, well, I'm glad you used the word tectonic shift. I think that Afghanistan was one of those. And another one was the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. And when that vote came to the UN Security Council, the UAE abstained from voting to condemn Russia and instead said that the conflict could be solved only by diplomacy, not condemnation and sanctions. So I think you're right to say, or maybe perhaps it was Mr. Kovalik who said that the countries of the Middle East are reassessing their relations to the U.S. empire and the rest of the world and trying to maintain some independence of foreign policy action. And and I think that's a good thing, rather than being tied so strongly to the U.S. bully. But as for your question concerning Palestine, it was reprehensible that the UAE recognized the apartheid regime in Jerusalem. But, you know, countries in the Middle East that are looked down upon here in the West as somewhat inferior and called names by people like Trump here, they have a long history of diplomatic relations, and they know how to maintain diplomatic relations with a whole rainbow of countries that some are of whom some are friends of theirs, of each other, and some are enemies of each other. They have a certain sophistication in foreign relations that we have also here in the West. So it's not totally surprising that the UAE could make relations, establish relations with Israel, however reprehensible, while at the same time trying to reestablish relations with Syria. It's probably may even be trying to have the role of a honest broker. We can only see as things unfold over time.
Well, things are unfolding. This visit by President Bashar al-Assad, Daniel Kovalik, is pretty big, going to the UAE. And the last time around, it was the UAE foreign minister. They have signed, from what we understand, MOUs. They want to expand their businesses with each other. You even have other countries, such as Lebanon, such as Jordan, who also want to really revive their ties with President Bashar al-Assad. part of that is expanding business ties, but they can't really do that, can they, if there is this huge thing called the Caesar's sanction that the U.S. has leveled against Syria. So these countries are saying, you know, this needs to be removed because they want to do business. So do you think the U.S. will fold to that? Or is it going to say we don't care because we don't have official recognition of Assad?
I don't see the U.S. doing it in the short term or even medium term. I don't even see even debate happening in the U.S. around that. But these countries may end up circumventing the sanctions. Again, with Saudi Arabia saying it may not even trade in the dollar. And now, of course, with these sanctions against Russia, Russia is going to find alternative means of transferring monies outside the SWIFT system. China is going to join that. Iran's going to join that. And other countries are going to join that. So they may find ways around that. And they may undermine the sanctions on their own without them even being lifted. Again, I think the U.S. has overplayed their hands with all these sanctions. They've tried to sanction the world. In the end, they're going to sanction themselves right out of the world economy. And we're seeing that happen.
It's funny. When you were saying that, I was thinking they're sanctioning themselves probably as a result. And that you just said those words. Okay, so is that what's happening, Kent Stone, perhaps? We are looking, of course, we did not talk about Iran much. We can't just say all the countries in this region, they are all aligned and they are all doing well with each other, because that's not the case. We have major differences still, like the war in Yemen, where Iran stands for the helpless people of Yemen and is still getting bombed. But if those things were to get smoothed out, does that mean really that the U.S. would be left out in the cold? And the alignment of the regional countries would then ensure the security that perhaps they were looking towards the U.S., but now they're realizing they could provide for themselves.
Well, that's a profound wish for the future. I heartily agree that the U.S. should be forced out of the Middle East. It's kept an iron hand on the Middle East for 70 years and caused immense hardship, pain, misery, wars, and turned people into refugees. So getting the U.S. out of the Middle East as a power broker would be a great leap forward for all the people and all the countries of the region. And I think that there may be a changing, there may be a shifting of alliances as the countries of the Middle East look at what happened in Afghanistan, look at what's happening right now in Europe, in Ukraine, and they look at the growing power and economic revival in Iran and say, hey, maybe it's time to change how we do business.
Very well. Thank you so much for that. Kent Stone from Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. Thank you. Author and researcher Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, PA. Thank you so much for your input. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. For me, Kovitak, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.